This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, who's actually banking on the Dakota Access Pipeline?
But now, even before the Dakota Access's pipeline security turned violent, activists faced really harsh responses as Governor Dalrymple declared a state of emergency, removing water and sanitation resources from the reservation, and the police have set up roadblocks around the reservation. Dozens of protesters have already been arrested, and police have spread false rumors of violence from the peaceful protesters.
But as the struggle continues, that it's been an important victory on the legal front, as U.S. District Court Judge Daniel Hovland has dissolved a temporary restraining order against Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chairman Dave Archambault and other participants in the protest against the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
National Lawyer Guild attorney Jeff Haas has retired momentarily from a meeting on the indigenous struggle against the pipeline to preserve native lands and culture and safeguard the environment. And he joins us now to talk about this critical struggle and what the role of lawyers has been in, frankly, the lifting of the federal injunction. Thanks for being with us, Jeff.
Glad to be here.
So where are things now, and what should we know and understand about Judge Daniel Hovland's ruling? How important is it?
I think it was important because I think it was sort of a recognition that the federal courts are not the place to stop these kind of demonstrations, and that he realized he would just be hauling people into federal court who had criminal cases against them, and they'd have the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, and it would be chaotic and probably would allow another forum for why the water protectors are doing what they're doing. His decision was basically to dissolve the TRO that had been entered against the tribe so that at least people who go out and protest, they may or may not be charged with criminal offenses, but they won't be charged with injunction or contempt of court.
Can state officials do an injunction also, or is this countermand that also?
Well, I guess they could. I don't know that slap suits kind of work if people obediently are doing the same thing every day, but when tactics change and when people lock down on machinery, even though peaceably, I don't think they're going to stop them with a federal suit. And like I said, it might provide another forum. But what they have done is they're increasing the criminal charges here. What was a misdemeanor before has now become a felony, reckless endangerment. So that the bonds are going up and the criminal penalties are going up.
How much are you involved in the day-to-day activity in response to the state of emergency that's been declared, the actual arrest? And I don't know if people are still incarcerated from the arrest. Can you tell us more about actually what has been happening with that?
There have been about over 70 people arrested, some for actions, some for trespass, some for being press who were covering actions. It's pretty broad, and most recently they've started with these mass arrests. Of course, everybody knows that Jill Stein, there's a warrant out for her, and Amy Goodman, there's a warrant out for her. So they're trying to really chill people from coming, from covering it with the media. So we're just starting to, these dates, arraignment, they're 12, or I think they're 20 arraignments in Mandan, which is the nearest county seat. So getting lawyers through the Lawyers Guild and getting people signed up and getting local lawyers to work on these cases is a lot what we're doing right now.
To what extent is this also now a struggle, a really holistic struggle of more than the Sioux people from that area, but really representative of the entire effort for self-determination of the indigenous peoples of this continent?
The Sioux, it started with the Standing Rock tribe, and immediately I think the seven other Sioux tribes have joined them. But when you go into the camp, there are over almost 200 flags of Native nations who've come in. And when you go there almost daily, a new nation arrives with a bus or with a caravan of cars or with a group of canoes. And they go through this ritualistic acceptance and can we come to your land? And yes, you're welcome here. And here's a gift. And it's beautiful. It's ceremonial. And it's a lot about indigenous rights everywhere, and everywhere from Alaska and the Northwest and the Cherokees and the Navajo are all here. And I think they realize it is about indigenous rights, and it's about water, and it's about protecting the planet and sacred sites. It's really a conflation of a lot of important issues for Native Americans in particular and their sovereignty rights, but all of us, because I think they're really doing this to save the earth, which they've always had a consciousness about that we haven't.
So aside from defense work, criminal defense work, because of the dozens of protests that have already been arrested and so on, is there any affirmative litigation that looks at challenging the financial institutions that are financing and profiting from the Dakota Access Pipeline, or other kind of creative litigation that may ensue to work towards stopping this pipeline from being installed further?
Uh-huh. Well, apparently the D.C. Circuit overruled the district judge in Washington and has granted at least a TRO on 20 miles east and west of the Missouri River or the lake that's adjoining it. So that's pending that appeal. We're also contemplating a suit against these roadblocks because they're stopping people. Local law enforcement is pulling people over for crooked license plates and dirty license plates and looking up arrests and using identification methods to see if people have been in demonstrations. And I think there is an increasing focus on the banks. So almost all the major banks, plus two Japanese banks, are involved in the financing of this. So there have been demonstrations everywhere, at Bank of America and Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs. So I think they're becoming an increased target, at least of protesters and of consciousness. And I don't know of a lawsuit yet that's been filed against them, but that's certainly a vulnerable point.
Are the protests as strong now as they were like a week ago or 2 weeks ago? Is things still building?
The mass actions have decreased a little bit. I just got back up here literally about half an hour ago. So I have to find out. But the determination to stop the building of the pipe and the construction is as strong as ever. And there have been a lot of arrests. People are still going out and still arrested and are sometimes doing this locking down on some of the machinery. And so they go out and find where they're continuing the construction. And yesterday a woman went out to video the fact that the pipeline is still being laid west of the Missouri, possibly within the area that they've been enjoined in the D.C. circuit, and she gets arrested for taking a video. So
she probably was one of the people with the crooked license plate and the dirty license plate. I love that, if that's actually charges that they're leveling. But, you know, I'm also wondering about things like environmental impact suits, CEQA suits, and so on. Is that in the cards as an additional support mechanism for the outstanding and rigorous united protests that have emanated from the Standing Rock Sioux tribes?
Well, the slogan here is water is life. And so that's a very fundamental fear here, is that this pipeline will go under the Missouri River and under this lake. I think it's the Waihee, which is where the Standing Rock tribe gets their water source. And the Missouri is the water source for, I think, about 20 million people. So that environmental impact, and also in the tribal resolutions, the fact that this pipeline would bring 500,000 barrels of Bakken oil every day to the Midwest, possibly to the Gulf. And that, I think they said that's equivalent to like adding 20 million cars. So yeah, that's huge environmental impacts, not to mention just the desecration of sacred sites right after an archaeologist identified in D.C. that in the direction of the pipeline were these sacred sites and recreations of astronomical bodies that had been done hundreds of years ago. The next day is when they came out and bulldozed that area, and that's the area that we all have seen in the videos where they had the private security guards with dogs.
Jeff Haas, the last time I spoke to you, you were actually out on a hike, and I'm taking that to mean that you take this struggle, aside from the political imperative for your involvement as a National Lawyers Guild lawyer, that you also take it very, very personally, and that it has a deep and profound resonance with you. And I wonder if you can talk about what you think this means to the people of the land, what it certainly means for indigenous culture, but what the indigenous people's efforts here mean to all of us who want to preserve the environment and recognize its profound decimation through these awful organizations of capital, such as Wells Fargo and these other banks that are involved in financing.
That's a really good question. And the other day, you know, I was thinking, and I've been an activist and defended movements going back to the Black Panthers and SDS and the anti-war movements. And so this is another movement where people have come together and taken a stand and put their lives on the line. And that's part of the reason I'm here. But part of the reason I'm here is I'm angry at what they're trying to do to our planet. I have four children and a granddaughter. Their fight, this fight is for all of us. This is not just for indigenous people. What they're trying to protect be our water supply, our environment, prevent this oil from adding to climate change. So I think they're leading the struggle really for all of us involved in environmental issues and water issues and indigenous rights issues. So I do take it personally. And anybody who walks out and wants to hold on to the beauty of the earth should see this as a stand for all of us.
Well, Jeff Haas, I know you have to return to your meeting. I want to thank you for the outstanding work and really decades of work that you've done on people's power issues for the environment, for human and civil rights. You're an outstanding advocate. And thank you for taking a little bit of time tonight to leave your meeting and to educate us and to help continue to build support for our sisters and brothers who are leading the struggle. And I just guess, lastly, do you see any parallel? I mentioned Wounded Knee. Do you think this is kind of in the spirit of Wounded Knee?
I absolutely do. And I think this is the largest gathering of tribes maybe for a century or maybe, who knows, forever. But yeah, it is. And certainly one of the demands here should be and is Free Leonard Pelletier, and I just saw Leonard, who's the defendant, of course, who's still in prison from the Wounded Knee for something he didn't do, a murder that they've admitted he didn't commit. So it's definitely connected. And their AIM, American Indian Movement, people here who were at Wounded Knee. So I thank you for what you said, but it's really an honor and inspiring to be here. And so I look at it, an opportunity to be close to this dramatic stand for all of us.
And thank you for mentioning Brother Leonard Pelletier. Obama, before you leave office, we've got to free Leonard Pelletier. Grant that pardon.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, and we'll continue to stay in touch and keep our listeners abreast of the issue. We have been speaking with Jeff Haas, National Lawyers Guild lawyer extraordinaire, working for decades for People's Power. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Indian legislation's on the desk of a do-right congressman. Now, he don't know much about the issue, so he picks up the phone and he asks advice of the senator out in Indian country, a darling of the energy companies who are ripping off what's left of the reservations. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart in Wounded Knee, deep in the earth. Cover me with pretty lies.
So we're moving to the next component of looking at the struggle that's been going on against the Standing Rock Sioux people with the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And as our last guest said, it is reminiscent, and it's the largest gathering since certainly Wounded Knee. And Hugh McMillan, senior researcher on water, energy, and climate issues at the Food and Water Watch, you recently wrote the report which states, powerful oil and gas companies are taking appalling steps to override the Sioux Indians' objections, using their immense financial resources to push for building the Dakota Access Pipeline, which will further line their pockets.
Hugh McMillan, who are the companies funding the project, and how are they doing that, and what aspects of the project are they funding?
Well, it's a long list of international banks and U.S. banks, a lot of the household names, Wells Fargo and Citibank, TD Securities. These are banks that are, along with 14 others, are providing the project-level financing, so directly to build Dakota Access, as well as convert a pipeline that would connect the south end of Dakota Access to Texas refineries and export markets. All told, the 38 banks have provided over $10 billion in capital to the Energy Transfer family of companies. Energy Transfer Partners, Sunoco Logistics are the two in that family that are spearheading this Dakota Access Pipeline and the larger Bakken Pipeline project, all the way from near the Canadian border down to the Gulf of Mexico.
It sounds like, you know, and part of your article, it does take me back to Occupy Wall Street and some of the demonstrations there. And, you know, we've got your Goldman Sachs and your Wells Fargo, who's certainly my favorite poster child for despising banks, and Morgan Chase and SunTrust, and I know that there are Japanese companies that are involved in this. What do they get out of it? What's the return, and why so many of these banks and financial institutions? Why are they fostering such widespread drilling, or is it just these same entities are also throughout the country fostering drilling and fracking to increase our darn disastrous dependence on fossil fuels?
On the financing of Energy Transfer Partners, you can find the details in the list of all the banks at foodandwaterwatch.org. You know, what you'll see with these banks funding Energy Transfer family of companies, it's just a slice of the much larger fracking pie for these banks. As of early this year, just six banks alone, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Citibank, they held over $200 billion in oil and gas industry loans. Working together with oil and gas companies, their front groups and think tanks, these banks have succeeded in establishing a U.S. energy policy that equates widespread fracking and maximizing production of oil and gas with energy security. Our executive director at Food and Water Watch calls the tangle of interest the fracopoly. And these banks aim to get paid back through widespread drilling and fracking, as you say, for decades to maximize oil and gas production at the expense of targeted communities and the stability of our climate. And, you know, they've succeeded in establishing this policy that equates widespread fracking with energy security and view these investments as very long-term, stable investments, fully confident that the United States will extract as much oil and gas as possible in spite of what we know about climate science and the need to keep as much as possible in the ground.
The federal government under Obama recently put a stay on buildings on federal land. What is the significance of that? I mean, will that stop the pipeline, or will the pipeline just go on private lands?
It stopped construction on Army Corps lands surrounding a lake there near the confluence of the Missouri and Kennebaw rivers. So just this small section. And the construction is continuing on private lands. Farmers and landowners are seeing their property rights violated as energy transfer companies and also Enbridge, Marathon, and Phillips 66, which have stakes in this pipeline, are able to exercise eminent domain and force these landowners to have the oil pipeline on their property.
Hugh McMillan, one of the things I'm interested in is politically, how do these financial organizations, they obviously give the money to finance the contractors, etc., but what do they also do to assure that they get the kind of permits and cooperation with the politicos to enable them to really rob people of their self-determination, endanger the land, endanger the environment, and so on?
There's certainly a long history of oil and gas companies and their financial backers establishing policies, getting loopholes in environmental laws, getting incentives in the tax code that promote oil and gas extraction, that promote widespread drilling and fracking. You know, think tanks are certainly an interface between the policymakers and the banks and industry. Citibank, for example, they've, along with Goldman Sachs and numerous other banks, are giving money to think tanks that are putting out think pieces promoting oil and gas production in the false name of energy security and energy independence, going so far as to promote the export of domestic oil and gas from fracking in the name of energy independence and energy security.
Now, this is a pipeline that would end up someplace in Illinois, and then as of now, the oil would be trucked down to the refineries probably in the south and near New Orleans. But there's
Energy Transfer Partners has another project. They're converting a gas pipeline to an oil pipeline. And so collectively, the Dakota Access would run 1,100 miles from near the Canadian border down to southern Illinois, where it would connect with this pipeline being converted, and that would run another 700 miles down to Texas. There in southern Illinois, oil from Dakota Access would also be put on trains and sent to the East Coast on what we've come to call bomb trains.
Would that require additional funding, or the $11 billion that you mentioned before that is the banks are pouring in right now for that also?
Right. So the $2.5 billion in direct project level financing to these pipeline companies covers evidently the costs that are remaining for both the Dakota Access Pipeline and the conversion of the gas pipeline that would connect from the south end of Dakota Access on down to the Gulf Coast of Texas, where there are more refineries and also export infrastructure.
But there's other monies involved also, like $10.5 billion total. So what are those other monies being used for?
Those are going toward the larger program at the Energy Transfer family of companies. So, for example, Energy Transfer is constructing a gas pipeline that's cutting across Big Bend of Texas for export to Mexico. And Energy Transfers has numerous other projects where they're building out infrastructure, sinking these billions of dollars into infrastructure to support more drilling and fracking when we know that that flies in the face of climate science.
You know, one of the things that interested me about doing this piece on the financing structure, the financial institutions and banks, was because for people who cannot make it down to North Dakota, we should begin to think about secondary boycotts, in effect, whether it's withdrawing money from these banks, directly picketing them, putting pressure on their investors, et cetera, to stop allowing for the financing of these fracking and drilling projects. I wonder if you have any additional thoughts from a senior researcher on food, energy, and climate issues at Food and Water Watch as to what we should be thinking about and doing in response, particularly to the Dakota Access Pipeline and these financial institutions.
There's been a number of actions against these banks, and it's served the purpose of spreading the awareness that, you know, it's not just the pipeline companies that are pushing these projects, but it's the system that's financing these projects. At the same time, it's writing oil and gas and U.S. energy policy. You can take your money out of these banks and put them in community banks, credit unions and the like. And that will send a message.
Have you heard anything coming out of either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump on this issue?
I've not. It will be interesting to see if Clinton does comment, although it's taken some time. I know that, of course, in the case of Donald Trump, right. his brain on energy is Harold Hamm, who is the CEO of Continental Resources. One publication, DSmog Blog, revealed that he would be expecting, his company is expecting to send significant amounts of oil down the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Just lastly, to be clear, when you have a Citibank and a Wells Fargo and a UBS and a JP Morgan Chase and a Goldman Sachs and a Bank of America and a SunTrust and Credit Suisse, etc., how do all of these entities involved in this financing, how do they actually turn their profit?
They get a return on this investment. So it's the interest plus several percentage points. Considered a stable fixed income for these banks in a multi-decade investment. And that is hinging on the United States extracting as much oil and gas as it can in the coming decades. And that conflicts with what we know about our obligations in as we face the urgent crisis of climate change.
In the last moments that we have, Hugh McMillan, how do these companies, these financial institutions and bank, how do they really comport themselves with the powerful oil and gas companies and the steps that they are taking to override the Sioux Indians' objections? What's the primary mechanism, or are there many, that they use to rob the Sioux Indians of their self-determination?
Well, I mean, I think for these banks funding Dakota Access, it's not really registering it as something they're doing. They are just diversifying and funding many, many pipeline infrastructure projects, not just Dakota Access.
Well, Hugh McMillan, where can we get a copy of your report?
At foodandwaterwatch.org.
And there's so many other great things on the Food and Water Watch website. We want to thank Hugh McMillan, Senior Researcher on Water, Energy, and Climate Issues at Food and Water Watch, for a report, for talking to us about these really powerful oil and gas companies that are taking appalling steps to override the Sioux Indians' objections to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.